Thank you to everyone who has listened to Case Notes and helped us become one of the most popular podcasts on iTunes in our first week. Subscribe to hear episodes on any device as soon as they come out, and please do leave us a review. Hidden away in the centre of Naples is a peaceful square, the Piazza San Domenico Maggiore. Residents come here to escape the heat and noise of the city. There's a cafe where they can get their morning espresso. Birds perch on the outstretched hand of a statue of Saint Dominic that towers above the square. Here, 400 years ago, an extravagant wedding took place. Don Carlo Gesualdo, patriarch and heir to an enormous fortune, married his cousin, the radiant Donna Maria d'Avalos. The rich and powerful crowded the streets. And then the festivities continued next door, in the Grand Palazzo San Severo. Four years later, in this very palace, Donna Maria would be brutally murdered. It's an event that seals the reputation of the composer Carlo Gesualdo forever. And it becomes known across Europe as the crime of the century. How did she, one of the most famous aristocrats of 16th century Naples, meet her end at the hands of her own husband? And how did he get away with it? This is Case Notes, a podcast investigating some of music's darkest mysteries from Classic FM. I'm Tim Lioro. In this episode, The Gesualdo Murders. In the late 16th century, Italy wasn't the country we know today. It was a collection of warring states, controlled by powerful families. In the north, the Medici family ruled. They produced three popes, two queens of France, and founded one of the most prosperous banks in all Europe. They were formidable. But having so much power was dangerous. These were murderous times. And even if you weren't murdered, death was everywhere. Infection, childbirth, wars, life here was short and brutal. But this is also the century of the masterpieces of Michelangelo and Da Vinci, the science of Galileo and Copernicus. It's a time of exploration, discovery, and experimentation. Just as this golden age is coming to an end, Carlo Gesualdo is born. His family has ruled this area of Campania since the 11th century. They've even adopted the name of a local town as their surname. But the real power in 16th century Italy is the church. And the Gesualdos have friends in high places there. Carlo's mother is a niece of Pope Pius IV, and his uncle is a cardinal.
He's born in 1566, and like all second sons, really his path is the priesthood, as is the case with all second sons of the time.
Claire Norbin is a playwright and singer who's written a show inspired by Gesualdo's life.
And so he is sent away to study with the Jesuits in Rome at the age of seven. And this is just around the time that his mother dies, which obviously is terribly traumatic event. So he spends the next 10 more years studying to become a priest. The Jesuits, obviously, the Jesuit training is really, really tough. There are spiritual beatings. He's got an uncle in Rome, Uncle Carlo Borromeo. So he's got family there, but he's very isolated and very alone.
Gesualdo's life follows a strict daily routine. He makes no decisions. He is responsible for no one apart from himself. He lives a life away from the real world, distanced from the pressures of making a good marriage and providing an heir. If you like, he's the Prince Harry of the Renaissance. But in 1584, all that changes.
He's gearing himself up to become a priest. Then suddenly, his brother dies.
And for Gesualdo, this is life-changing.
And overnight, suddenly the plans change. He's called back from Rome, and suddenly the orders are, right, you're responsible for fathering the next generation of the Gesualdo clan. And he isn't really in a position to know what that means.
What it means is this. Gesualdo is ripped away from the priesthood. His old life is gone in an instant. Now, he is the future of the Gesualdo family. His books, his routine, and his music are replaced by new responsibilities. He must marry and produce an heir. His life is now reduced to this. But there's a problem. He's an awkward 20-year-old with no interest in anything except music.
Hello, I'm Dinko Fabris, an Italian musicologist. I'm teaching at the University of Matera. He was not interested at all in the girl, was not interested at all in the family problems. He was just interested in music.
A suitable wife is found for Gesualdo. She's the daughter of another powerful family.
So it was not at all a love. Affair was really a business.
This marriage is nothing more than a financial alliance. The woman Gesualdo is set to marry is his cousin, Donna Maria d'Avalos. She's 25, and this is her third marriage. It's not her first rodeo, as they say.
Maria was considered the beautiful lady in Naples, the most incredible and talented lady for society, a living life in all kind of public events.
She would have been a familiar face at banquets and jousts. Her family was well known, and she was a respected and well-liked member of high society. She was a 16th century it girl. Maria's first husband died in 1578, just 3 years into their marriage. An account from the time says he died of, quote, an excess of connubial bliss. Overindulged in hanky-panky, threading the needle, rolling in the hay, doing the horoscope. In other words, he died from too much sex. Her second husband died only a few months before she married Gesualdo.
On the contrary, the young Gesualdo was completely out of this kind of life, was all the time at home playing his lute, composing music, writing letters.
This bookish introvert was a terrible match for the experienced Donna Maria d'Avalos. The result was catastrophic.
I've imagined that when the wedding night comes, his bride is his cousin Maria, who's older than him. She's had two previous husbands, one of whom is reportedly died of an excess of connubial bliss, is the wonderful contemporary reference. And so there is poor Gesualdo, and he does not know what to do. And Maria is obviously quite a sexual animal. So she goes off and has a number of affairs, particularly with a nobleman called Fabrizio Caraffa.
Fabrizio was handsome, described as an Adonis for his beauty and a Mars for his fury. Quite the combination.
From glances of love, they proceeded to written messages.
Here's the story according to a tabloid newspaper of the time.
They met alone for the first time in the garden of Don Garcia of Toledo. Seeing her approach, he came without wasting time, and taking her in his arms, kissed her 1,000 times.
They tried to keep their passionate affair a secret. Servants run between the houses with neatly folded messages. Maria and Fabrizio conspire to see each other alone. They fake sudden illnesses, bribe servants, persuade friends to hide them in secret rooms. They sometimes even sneak into Donna Maria's own bedroom to make love, with a maid standing guard outside. Meanwhile, in the very same palace, Gesualdo is clueless, tucked away alone in his study. He's conducting a love affair of his own, with his music.
It's too easy just to say that, you know, this is a madman writing, as it was sort of fashionable too early on. It's beautifully put together. And also, at the same time that we say it's tremendously modern, it's also tremendously old-fashioned.
Professor Robert Hollingworth is reader of music at the University of York.
I wouldn't say it's traditional. I think he wrote for a traditional ensemble, but he wrote for it in a very advanced way, and I think he pushed it to as far as you can go. This is not generally music for amateur choirs to have a gentle sing through. There are three things, perhaps, about Gesualdo's writing that's extraordinary. One is the unsettled nature, how it can be very, very slow-moving, and then very, very fast, right in the next bar. Another is the sheer advanced harmony that he uses.
For advanced harmony, read weird and unusual chords. This would become Gesualdo's signature move.
But the other, almost the most striking, is how he can use perfectly normal chord progressions, but then takes them off in a way you hadn't expected. The term to use him as a melomaniac, that he was obsessed by music. So actually it wasn't just the arts, it was music. He would talk the hind legs of a donkey about music.
Gesualdo finds out about the affair, but he finds out about it in quite an interesting way. His uncle Giulio, decides that he rather likes Maria, so he tries to seduce her. She says, "No thanks, Giulio." And so in a pique of jealousy, he tells Gesualdo, Carlo Gesualdo, that his wife is having an affair. And Gesualdo... That's a real moment.
A moment that will come to define his life.
Gesualdo is really placed in this position where he sort of has to act.
Today, if you discover your partner is cheating, you might throw the china, slam the door, argue over who gets the dog and the vinyl collection. You could get a divorce. You can move away, start afresh. But for Gesualdo, in the violent patriarchal society of 16th century Italy, things are very different, and his options are few.
The idea that a man would respond with violence to that sort of... It was seen as an affront to him, to his honour, particularly among the aristocracy. It was seen as almost an injury to something that he owned. Responding with violence to that was appropriate. In the same way, at the same time, killing a burglar whom you find in your house, that was also excused and tolerated in the same way as killing a lover found with your wife.
Professor Trevor Dean specialises in violent crime in Renaissance Italy.
Levels of assault and homicide were much higher than they are today. I've worked on the city of Bologna in the 15th century, and at certain points in that century, the rate of wife murder was running at 50 times the rate today.
This is the moment Gesualdo acts. This is when he steps over into a different life. He turns his back on one path and chooses to take another. He cements his fate as a composer who will be remembered, but not for his music. It is October 1590. Don Carlo Gesualdo and Donna Maria Davalos have been married for 4 years. They have one son, and there are whispers that another is on the way. But Donna Maria feels trapped. She's found refuge in an affair with another nobleman, Don Fabrizio. And now, her husband has found out.
There are actually two recorded eyewitness accounts of the offences. One is from Gesualdo's manservant.
His name is Pietro.
And the other is from his wife Maria's serving maid.
Dr. Ruth McAllister is a consultant forensic psychiatrist who's examined the case in great detail.
They made sworn statements to the local magistrate the following day. And what they said, pulling together the two eyewitness accounts, was that Gesualdo's wife, Maria, had gone to bed at the usual time, and then her lover joined her.
These are the events of that tragic, bloody evening, as told by those who witnessed it. Be warned. This doesn't make for easy listening.
Silvia is the wardrobe mistress to Donna Maria. She and her maid go to bed at the usual time in the anteroom to Maria's bedchamber. The maid falls asleep and Silvia starts to prepare clothes for the next day. And then she hears her mistress, that's Maria Davalos, calling her, asking for clothes. She's heard the Duke whistle and she wants to go out on the balcony. Donna Maria asks Silvia to stand guard and warn her if she hears anybody stir in the palace or the courtyard. Then half an hour later, she comes into bed and she asks for an extra nightshirt, which Silvia brings for her.
Donna Maria locks the door. What she doesn't know is that Gesualdo has tampered with the locks, changing them from metal to wood so that they can be easily broken.
Gesualdo dines in his own rooms on the mezzanine floor and goes to bed at the usual time. But later in the night, he calls for a glass of water. Pietro goes to draw water from the well and he can see that the gate is open. He goes back to find his master dressed and asking for a cloak. Pietro says, "Where are you going at this late hour?" Gesualdo says he's going hunting. Pietro says, "This is no time for hunting." And Gesualdo says, "You shall see what hunting I am going to do."
Pietro testified in court. What you're about to hear is how his words were interpreted by a tabloid of the time.
He mounted his horse, pretending to go to a place called Astroni, 82 miles from Naples. In the meantime, he left orders with several of his most trusted servants that during the night they should leave all the necessary doors open, that they should pretend that the doors are shut, and they should watch to see if the Duke were to come. The prince then left and went to hide himself in the home of a relative of his until it was time to leave.
He asks for two torches and he pulls weapons from under the bed. A sword, a dagger, a stiletto and an arquebus, which is a firearm.
Having entered the house, he betook himself with dispatch to the bedroom of the princess, in front of which was stationed a careful sentinel.
Gesualdo runs to the staircase which leads up to Donna Maria's apartments, saying, "I am going to slay the Duke of Andrea and that strumpet, Donna Maria." On the way upstairs, Pietro sees three men, each carrying a halberd and an arquebus. He recognises them, and he later gives their names to the magistrate. The men throw open the doors to Donna Maria's apartment.
As soon as the three men had entered the said room of Donna Maria, Don Carlo said, "Kill the scoundrel, along with his harlot. Shall a Gesualdo be made a cuckold?"
"Shall a Gesualdo be made a cuckold?"
And the prince, breaking down the door of the bedroom with a blow of his foot and entering the room in a blaze of anger, finds his wife lying naked in bed, in the arms of the Duke.
Then Gesualdo comes out of the bedroom with his hands covered in blood and goes back in again, saying, "I do not believe they are dead." And at this point, Pietro follows him into the bedroom and sees a dead body near the door, which is the Duke. Gesualdo goes up to the bed of Donna Maria and deals her still more wounds, saying, "I do not believe she is dead."
The bodies were dragged outside the room and left on the stairs. The prince, ordering the servants not to move them from that place, and having made a placard that explained the slaughter, left with some of his relatives to Venosa.
And then goes down the staircase and leaves on horseback.
The bodies are left where they fell. When the authorities arrive, this is what they find.
The bodies are found where they died. They're not on display. This is from the proceedings of the Grand Court. The Duke has been shot through the left arm, the wound entering his breast. The nightshirt is scorched and soaked with blood. There are many wounds made by pointed steel weapons on the breast, arms, head and face. And there's another gunshot wound in the temple over the left eye. When the Duke is moved, when they turn him over, he's found to have wounds penetrating right through his body, and the swords have made deep holes in the floor under his body. Donna Maria is found in the bed, dressed in a nightshirt, all bathed with blood. With her throat cut, a wound in the temple, a stab wound to the face, several dagger wounds on her right hand and arm, which may have been defense wounds, and sword wounds on her breast and flank.
Professor Trevor Dean.
So it was a very bloody scene. All the reports say that there was a lot of blood in the room when they saw the bodies there. And so the fact that she'd had her throat cut, I think, is highly significant. That's one of the things that interests me about it, because in the work I've done on homicide, women have their throats cut much more frequently than men do. This is an injury that men inflict on women, and men do not inflict so much on men. So it's a very gendered form of violence. Whereas the lover, Fabrizio, he was shot, and that's very clear. There was a gunshot wound in his elbow, and then a gunshot wound in his head, and there was an entry wound and an exit wound by the eye, in the temples, by the eyes. So he was clearly shot.
It's evident from the pattern of Fabrizio's wounds that he had put his arm over his face. He was desperately trying to shield himself.
Gesualdo and his servants, they go into the room, they shoot the lover, and then they cut the woman's throat. So I think that's a very clear gender difference in the mode of killing.
I had assumed that it was a straightforward crime of passion, and that, there would be a fairly typical story of somebody overcome with jealousy and completely losing control and committing this terrible offence in a frenzy and then being very remorseful. But when I looked into it, and that's not what I found at all. Looking at the facts of what he did as a psychiatrist in the modern day, it strikes one as extraordinarily sadistic, in that there's an element of entrapment. It's very carefully planned, and he used overwhelming force, far more than was necessary to kill the lovers. He used a troop of men armed to the teeth with weapons of war, halberds and things like muskets. That, to me, to a modern-day psychiatrist, suggests that there were psychological forces driving his actions, not merely that they were expedient. Also, they were seen as unusual and disproportionate at the time. They did cause an outcry. People were scandalized. And it is recorded, I'm no expert on this, but it is well documented that there were alternatives.
He didn't have to kill her. There were other choices he could have made.
He could have had her put away in a convent, for example. That was a fairly conventional solution in those days. And divorce wasn't out of the question. So, bearing in mind, as I said, all of the reasons for being very careful about it, it does make you wonder how much his actions were driven by internal conflicts, because the nature of the crime scene suggests the reenactment of an earlier trauma in his life to a modern psychiatric mind. Analysts will sometimes say of homicide that the perpetrator is really trying to kill something within himself. And a striking feature of that account, to me, is that the killing doesn't solve the problem for Gesualdo. He does not believe that his wife is dead. And the first thing he has to do is go back in and kill her again. If what you're trying to kill is something inside you, then, of course, killing someone else can't solve your problem. And you will find that you are still living with the problem after they've gone.
Simply put, you can't kill the past. Gesualdo's pain and frustration at having to leave behind the simple life of the church, at losing control of his own life, at having to be the future of the family, it all comes out at this moment. Gesualdo believes he's got rid of his immediate problem, but the murder of Donna Maria Davalos would wreak havoc on his life in ways he could never imagine.
The message is one of perhaps of fear.
This may explain why he then left Naples and didn't come back.
Have mercy on me, wash me thoroughly from my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin.
It is February 1594, 4 years after Gesualdo slashed the throat of his wife and shot her lover. He arrives in Ferrara. His party is grand. He brings a retinue of 150 people, 300 pieces of luggage, and 24 mules. He wants to make a good impression. After all, he's here to meet his new bride. The woman who drew the short straw is Eleonora d'Este, daughter of one of the most powerful noble families in northern Italy. One description from the time says her virtues are so many that trying to describe them would be like trying to measure the waters of the ocean or count its grains of sand. The wedding is enormous. The day after Gesualdo arrives, the Duke of Ferrara holds a 23-course banquet in his honour. After dinner, there's entertainment, 52 knights taking part in a jousting tournament. And the festivities continue the next day with a sumptuous ballet, and the next day with another extravagant dinner. So much for the quiet second marriage.
During the 16th century, Ferrara became one of the most important emblems of the Italian Renaissance.
Dinko Fabbri.
So when Gesualdo arrived to Ferrara in 1594, he was attracted by the fact that he had this possibility to compete, to challenge the most musical court of Europe.
Gesualdo is at the height of his musical powers. The rich culture of Ferrara has given him renewed enthusiasm for music, for life. He gets competitive. He starts writing incredibly complex music to impress the cosmopolitan composers of Ferrara. He's pushing at the boundaries of what was thought possible in music at the time.
Gesualdo was considered a miracle by his society. It was not normal that an important prince was proud to show his skills in music. For the rules of the 16th century, the perfect nobleman should learn the music, learn the dancing, learn the singing, but never showing this as an ability like a professional.
Claire Norburn.
Ferrara is really exciting because it makes him feel like he's a composer, and it makes him feel he wants to be seen as a composer. It's about being published. It's about being seen as the great prince of culture. And that really matters. It really matters to Gesualdo what people think of him. Really does. And being this great composer it's important to him.
From the outside, he's a man on the threshold of an exciting stage in life. But he's haunted. While the bodies of his first wife and her lover were still warm, Gesualdo had fled the scene. He sought refuge in his castle, and the first thing he did when he returned was to cut down all the trees surrounding his estate. If anyone from Maria's family wanted to avenge her death, Gesualdo wanted to see them coming.
It is taking place in Gesualdo's head, and it's very much that, you know, he is a man of extremes, so he is either terribly praying and wanting to atone for his guilt, and then suddenly the next moment he is angry, vicious, nasty, and there isn't anything in between.
The law was on Gesualdo's side. It was legal to kill your wife if she was having an affair. But even at the time, people questioned the force Gesualdo used, the brutality of the murder, and whether it was really necessary. So it was entirely possible that one of the Davalos family would try and take revenge. And then, of course, there was Gesualdo's own conscience.
He is a man who has been brought up by the Jesuits, and he's been brought up to fear God. So I think he really fears that something terrible will happen to him. I think Gesualdo thinks, forevermore, I'm going to be trying to find a way to atone for this, and I'm going to go back and forth between trying to do good and feeling terrible about it and actually not being able to stop myself from sinning.
All this comes out in Gesualdo's music.
It's a cure. Music and these beatings. He used to have a servant whose sole duty was to whip him. And that's not, that sounds like some kind of sadomasochistic kind of ritual. And maybe there was something in that too, but actually it was his physician's cure. It was seen as a cure for headaches, and he suffered from constipation, you'll be pleased to know, as well. And so that was a cure.
Thankfully, time and medicine have moved on.
But music, I think he sees very much as a cure. And the way that I've structured the text is that the beginning, he's calling to his musicians to sing because he can't bear the silence. The silence brings Maria, and he's haunted by Maria. And he can't bear the silence. And he's safe when there's music. And I think that's partly why the music is so individualistic, is that he is pouring himself into that music.
Ruth McAllister.
I think it is interesting to look at the words that people choose to set. That's not an accident. It's not random. He wrote a lot of madrigals, secular love poetry, and it is quite conventional for the time. But the conventions are that the mistress is cruel, the loved one is cruel and rejecting. And the more cruel and rejecting she is, the more highly she is valued. And death is also highly valued in these texts. Now, lots of other people were setting similar texts at the time, but he sets them with enormous intensity, and he hardly does anything else. They're very repetitive, the words of his madrigals. There are lots of violent antitheses, so grievous joy, for example, or sweet pain. So violent contrasts and musical illustration of these in extraordinary ways. And the other thing that strikes me about the madrigals is that there's no progression. I mean, musically there is, but emotionally they're stuck in the same place. And it's as if in the madrigals he is rehearsing the torturous situation with his first wife over and over again.
Perhaps what we hear in Gesualdo's music is his conscience obsessively circling the same moments in his life. The marriage, the affair, the murder. Or perhaps not. It would be easy to suggest that Gesualdo was a reformed character, or that his guilt tormented him so much that he never mistreated another woman. But you don't have to look far to find he was a serial abuser.
His treatment of his second wife was terrible. He would try to prevent Eleonora from travelling, for example, to visit her family. He would write insistently for her to join him. But then when she did, he would either ignore her or mistreat her. He humiliated her, he ridiculed her, he was violent towards her in front of other people. In a letter, one of her brothers describes how Gesualdo grabbed her by the arms and threw her to the floor. He was unfaithful. He had mistresses and flaunted them in front of her eyes.
Gesualdo kills his first wife for having an affair. But those rules don't apply to men, and certainly not to men of nobility such as Gesualdo. His second wife, Eleonora, has one trick up her sleeve. She accuses two of her husband's mistresses of witchcraft. The story of the two women, Aurelia and Polisandra, is a strange one. Some of the testimony from the trial survives. The details are lurid. If you are eating, you may want to pause for a moment.
Aurelia made the prince drink her menstrual blood as a purgative. Aurelia declared Polisandra told her she should take a slice of bread and place it inside her nature.
That's a reference to her private parts, by the way.
And after it was saturated with her own seed, she would give it to the prince to eat with sauce. It is established through the doctor's deposition that the seed is harmful.
The two confessed under torture. But rather than being executed or sent to jail, their punishment was to be imprisoned in Gesualdo's own castle. Meanwhile, you'll be unsurprised to hear, his wife Eleonora spent as little time at home with her husband as possible. There is one piece of evidence that suggests Gesualdo's conscience wasn't entirely clear, and that he was, in fact, haunted by the murder. A clue from the very end of his life that reveals a tortured mind. It's in the Santa Maria della Grazia church in the composer's hometown of Gesualdo.
We're here to talk about a painting which is very unusual in many respects.
Guido Rebecchini, an expert in Italian Renaissance art, has examined it closely.
Images such as this sort of crystallize a relationship between the individual and God.
In 1609, Gesualdo commissioned a 5-meter-high altarpiece from the painter Giovanni Balducci. Christ sits at the top, holding a globe in his hand. He is surrounded by figures, including the Virgin Mary. They are framed by clouds and a bright, warm light. The lower half of the painting tells a different story.
In the middle, we have very bright flames, red, orange, from which a number of naked figures emerge. Some of them are showing signs of repentance through their gestures, while others are being lifted up by angels who hold them by the hand.
Gesualdo has placed himself in the corner of the painting, looking up at Christ imploringly. He is careful not to look at the flames, which are in touching distance. Mary Magdalene looks down at him. Perhaps she's pleading his desperate case. What is Gesualdo trying to say? Is this a cry for help?
I think here Gesualdo was absolutely specific. He must have told the painter which saints he wanted to be represented, how he wanted to be represented. He must have been very specific because the iconography is so unusual. It's not conventional. And therefore, it must have resulted from a discussion, from a dialogue between the artist and the patron, indeed. The message is one of perhaps of fear. It's fearful that his destiny is to end up in the flames.
He's terrified of going to hell. But Gesualdo's elaborate offering to God doesn't clear his conscience. Claire Norburn.
That guilt was always there from the Catholic Church, even though in many ways he turns his back on the Catholic Church. He has this, just as he has difficult relationships with women, he has a very difficult relationship with the Catholic Church, which is that he wants it desperately and he wants it all to be okay and he wants to be a good boy, and then he throws it all away and he can't do it. He just can't do it. Something perverse in my nature cannot, will not stop me from plunging myself deep into the blood and guts of sin.
Gesualdo was obsessed by music and fiercely competitive. He wrote music that was unlike anything that had ever existed before or since. But it was a dead end. And what's more, his music died out. It disappeared for centuries. Robert Hollingworth.
I don't think any of this music was very popular, really. I think we're talking about performance by very small numbers of people, by people who could afford music, which at least was a more middle-class thing in the 16th century since the advent of music printing in the 1520s. I think he is one end of Renaissance music. When he dies in 1613, that's a very convenient end to one type of style. Now, there are other composers that follow this for a while, but it can't really go anywhere. I certainly don't think it gets any better.
When Gesualdo was finally rediscovered in the 20th century, it was the murder that interested people the most. Gesualdo was desperate to be known for his creative genius, but today, his music is never spoken about in its own terms. In films, in books, in articles, radio programs, and podcasts, his work is seen through the lens of his violent acts. He escaped punishment for his crime during his lifetime because the killing, despite its brutality, was legal. But ever since, He's been known as the composer who murdered his wife and her lover. And that is who he'll always be. Many thanks to our guests, Robert Hollingworth, Claire Norbin, Dinko Fabris, Ruth McAllister, Trevor Dean, Guido Rebecchini, and Christian Witt. Recordings of Gesualdo's music were used courtesy of Glosser, Signum Records, and Delphian Records. Thanks also to John Labouchardière. Our theme music and additional compositions are by Thomas Hewitt Jones. Case Notes producers are Elizabeth Davis and Rachel Humphreys. Sound design and mixing is by Dave Bush. Megan Wastel is the executive producer. And special thanks go to Steve Wilson-Beals, Sam Jackson and James Hickman. Subscribe to the Case Notes series wherever you get your podcasts to hear the next episode as soon as it comes out. And we love reading your reviews, whether they're as long as a Tchaikovsky love letter or shorter than one of Mozart's rude jokes. Your review will help more people discover the podcast, so please, let us know what you think.